From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. That the war in Afghanistan is getting attention at all these days from members of the press is somewhat surprising. For a very long time, it seemed that the major story about the war there was that nobody was covering the war there.
The war on terror began in Afghanistan in the wake of 9/11, and while we tend to forget the war is still going on there, we got a reminder
today. The conflict
today,
in Iraq is the one we hear most about, and yet just 900 miles away in Afghanistan, some 25,000 American troops are fighting and dying.
Some 6 years on, it's the war most Americans have forgotten about.
Mark Jerkowitz is Associate Director at the Project for Excellence in Journalism. Mark, welcome back.
Thank you, Bob. Good to be here.
Can you quantify just how neglected the neglected war has been?
In all of 2007, all of the coverage of Afghanistan and the war in Afghanistan accounted for about 1% of the news hole, which is all the coverage that we look at. That's about 1/16th as much coverage as the war in Iraq got that year from the U.S. media. In 2008, which at that point was the bloodiest year for U.S. forces in Afghanistan, the story stayed at the same basic level. The Beijing Olympics got more overall coverage that year, at least in the media that we tracked, than the war in Afghanistan. Even in the beginning of 2009, when it was clear with the new Obama administration that it was, unlike Iraq, a war that he was determined to prosecute on some level, for the first half of the year 2009, it still only covered about 2% of the news hole. So you could say for the first 2.5 years that we looked at coverage of this war, it was, if not completely forgotten, dramatically overshadowed by almost all the other news of the day.
So what's going on now that all of a sudden Afghanistan is getting traction in the press?
There's been a sea change. And the real trigger, interestingly enough, is not necessarily what's going on over in Afghanistan, but actually the U.S. domestic policy debate. We can track the real spike in coverage to late August, and specifically the week of the August 20th elections, which are still being contested, which was the first week that in our index, coverage of Afghanistan actually got to 10% of all the coverage we monitored that week, culminating last week in the first time that we have looked at this in which Afghanistan was actually the leading story of the week. It accounted for 20% of the news hole. That means 1/5 of all the coverage of all the news stories that we looked at last week. That's twice as high as the previous high level of coverage. And what's interesting about that is when we began this news coverage evaluation back in early 2007, the Iraq war was the big story. It dominated. What was the aspect of the Iraq conflict that got the most coverage from the U.S. media? It was essentially the battle between George Bush and the Democratic Congress over how to prosecute the war. So one thing we've learned as we watch how wars are covered is that a big chunk of it really does revolve around the U.S. policy debate. And one reason, and not to simplify it, is frankly, it's a lot easier to put reporters in Washington, D.C. than it is in Kabul.
Much as early on in the Iraq war, it began to take on a kind of Vietnam cast, Afghanistan is beginning to look the same way, unwinnable, a lot of American deaths, and no clear idea of an end game.
We can go back in late 2001 at the inception of the war, before the Taliban fell. There was this sense that things weren't happening dramatically enough, and there was this initial spate of coverage that said, is the United States getting into a quagmire? Then obviously the Taliban fell, and that storyline evaporated. But now, 7 or 8 years later, it's back. We've seen the policy debate here sort of play out in public in the media with the surge option on one hand, and then what's often become in media shorthand the Biden option, which is a de-emphasis of ground troops in Afghanistan and a more of a targeted pinpoint focus on Al-Qaeda. There may be an option in between, but I think one of the underlying narratives of coverage of this is that there is no easy solution here, there is no guaranteed path to victory, and that the president is dealing with a bunch of options of which he may have to choose the lesser of evils.
One final thing, Mark. There are ebbs and there are flows. At the moment, coverage is flowing out of Afghanistan. Is Iraq suddenly now the neglected war?
Even for last year in 2008, coverage of Iraq was down three quarters from what it was in 2007. It's down even further from that now in 2009. Yes, in many respects, Iraq is now the forgotten war. You can make the argument, obviously, that circumstances dictate that. It's totally understandable. You can also make the argument that, frankly, the American news media, under current economic circumstances, closing foreign bureaus, losing staffers, cutting back and retreating, finds it very hard to cover two wars at one time. That may be the case as well.
All right, Mark. Thank you, as always.
Thanks, Bob. My pleasure.
Mark Jerkowitz is Associate Director for the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism.
As we heard, most of the coverage concerns the policy questions confronting the president. It's a complicated calculation, and underlying it all is history. Recently, we read that two books about the Vietnam War are being passed around Washington and shaping the debate over Afghanistan. The first, popular in military circles, is Lewis Sorley's A Better War, which argues that we might have won in Vietnam, but that just as new counterinsurgency tactics were starting to work, we had to withdraw because we had lost the war at home. The other book, Lesson in Disaster by Gordon Goldstein, traces how confused and contradictory military advice led to terrible decision-making by past presidents. That book is favored by White House insiders and has apparently appeared on Obama's nightstand. All of this reading is making New Yorker staff writer George Packer a little nervous. After reading Lesson in Disaster himself, he can see many similarities between Vietnam and Afghanistan, and President Kennedy's dilemma and Obama's. But, he says, presidents cannot find the path to the present in the past, although he can see why it's tempting.
The parallels were eerie, and it was just the easiest thing in the world to imagine Obama in John F. Kennedy's place. A new president inherits a conflict, has made some campaign promises about it, but at the same time is a very rational thinker who doesn't want to destroy his presidency by being bulldozed into a war by his military advisors. That was Kennedy's position. That is Obama's position. So it didn't surprise me that this book apparently has made its way to the presidential bedroom.
So, George, talk to me about books and presidents. We know that The Guns of August, which chronicled how the great powers of Europe spiraled uncontrollably into World War I, was very important to John F. Kennedy. He quoted from it often. He handed it out to everybody in the top ranks of the army. He used it as a cautionary tale when confronting a possible war in Southeast Asia.
The Guns of August really was not a particularly relevant historical analogy for Vietnam. You know, Bill Clinton inherited a war in Bosnia, and he had campaigned on the need for America to somehow intervene to stop it. He then picked up Robert Kaplan's Balkan Ghosts, which he took to mean stay out. This is an old, ancient blood feud, and no outsider can put an end to it. That was a very bad reading of the war in Bosnia. He went to the book that told him what he probably wanted to hear, because he, like Kennedy, did not want to begin his administration getting America deeper into a war that could consume his domestic agenda.
But then it seems that Clinton picked up Michael Sell's book, The Bridge Betrayed, Reform and Genocide in Bosnia, which argued that the ethnic conflict had ebbed and flowed through the years and that the West could make a difference.
Right. Well, I think these presidents get to the book at the moment when they want to. George W. Bush read something like 90 books in 2006, according to Karl Rove. They had a competition. Bush won. It's too bad that he didn't read any books that year that might have told him that the Iraq War was turning into a cataclysm, because he didn't seem to know it.
George Bush apparently did encounter one book that shaped him, though. It was by the famous Russian dissident who became an Israeli politician, Natan Sharansky, called The Case for Democracy.
Because it told him that people everywhere want to be free, and that once they're free and living under a democratic government, there will be no more terrorism. Again, when presidents go looking for books that provide a mirror to reflect their own views, I think books can be dangerous. What every president really should learn is that no two decisions are the same. No two wars are the same. You know, neither Lessons in Disaster nor A Better War can really tell Obama what to do and not do in Afghanistan.
You wrote in your blog posting that history tells you how to think, not what to think.
what I meant by that is in the case of Vietnam, you can read Lessons in Disaster and A Better War and learn a lot about the need to keep an open mind, mm-hmm. to listen to dissenting views, to ask hard questions about goals and strategies, to be brave enough to overrule your advisors who've been around a lot longer than you have. Those are all ways of thinking, but they cannot give you the answers, these books. They cannot tell you we need more troops in Afghanistan or we don't need more troops in Afghanistan because the early years in Vietnam went badly or because the later years in Vietnam went a little better. I think Obama does care about how he thinks and doesn't have all the answers sort of lined up on cue cards. And so his reading of these books, I think and hope, is designed to make him a better president by making him a better thinker and not simply to give him answers that only his own time and his own presidency can offer.
George, thank you very much.
Always my pleasure, Brooke.
George Packer is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of several books, including Interesting Times, Writings from a Turbulent Decade, out later this month.
And now an update on a new military rule governing photojournalists in the field of war. Last week, a group called the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press posted the month-old rule, which stipulates that, quote, the media will not be allowed to photograph or record video of U.S. personnel killed in action. That's a reversal of past policy, which stated that journalists can take pictures of slain service members, provided they wait for families to be notified before releasing the images. According to Congressional Quarterly, the new policy applies to eastern Afghanistan and is the direct result of a decision by the Associated Press to release a photo of Lance Corporal Joshua M. Bernard in the act of dying, despite his family's wishes and protests from Defense Secretary Robert Gates. The rule change surprised us because we spoke with Pentagon Press Secretary Jeff Morrell following the controversy over the AP photo. He told us in September that they did not plan to change the policy.
We're not looking to change any rules. We're not looking to make it more restrictive or more onerous for reporters to do their work. We are the biggest champions of reporters in the battlefield.
Morrell told us then that Defense Secretary Gates expected editors to use their best judgment when deciding to release photos. But at least in eastern Afghanistan, that decision has now been made for them and for their readers.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Hey, pod people. This is Katya, senior producer of OTM. Finally, for the first time ever, you can get an On the Media t-shirt, a notebook, a refrigerator magnet, a mouse pad, whatever. We got it. If you want it, you can find it by clicking the link on our website, onthemedia.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last Sunday, White House Communications Director Anita Dunn appeared on CNN's Reliable Sources and had this to say about the Fox News Channel.
Let's be realistic here, Howie. They're widely viewed as part of the Republican Party. Take their talking points, put them on the air. Take their opposition research, put them on the air, and that's fine. But let's not pretend they're a news network the way CNN is.
When asked if President Obama would at some time in the future make an appearance on Fox News, Dunn responded,
yes, obviously he'll go on Fox because he engages with ideological opponents.
It's not unusual for a president or member of his administration to attack the media as overly negative or even unfair, but to call out by name a particular news outlet, not for a single story, but for its whole approach, is unusual. Although, to be fair, the Bush White House did cast aspersions on the New York Times when it suited them. Howard Kurtz writes the Media Notes column for the Washington Post and is host of CNN's Reliable Sources.
She said it to me while I was sitting on the set at CNN, and I must say, this wasn't just Anita Dunn deciding that she's fed up with Fox. I have no doubt that there was a meeting or meetings about this and that she was carrying a message that the administration wanted out.
It's a little hard for the White House to do that, regardless of whether it may be true, and I think to a large degree it is true, because MSNBC could arguably be a wing of the Democratic Party.
Certainly MSNBC on the left, if you look at the primetime hosts, it's one liberal after another. They spent years bashing George W. Bush. They generally defend Barack Obama, but not necessarily the same situation during the day when you have NBC News reporters among those who are trying to play it straight. Clearly, the Obama White House has made a calculated decision that by going after Fox in this blunt fashion, that A, the administration can score some political points with its liberal base, which despises Fox and is probably cheering, and B, maybe embarrass Fox or somehow produce somewhat better treatment. I don't see that happening. And in fact, a lot of people, including some liberals, say President Obama should try to reach Fox's audience. He should go there and sit down with O'Reilly and he should make his case, leaving aside the people at Fox who get under his skin. It's a very highly rated cable news channel.
It is the highest rated 24-hour cable news channel and has been for some time. Fox News in July apparently had 1.2 million viewers across its broadcast day, which is twice as much as CNN's and way more than MSNBC's 400,000. But still, it's not a huge number, and it's kind of exaggerating Fox's potential impact.
I'm going to disagree with that, Brooke. Cable news, despite modest audiences compared to the big broadcast networks, has a disproportionate impact on the debate. Take two examples from Fox, the crusade led by Glenn Beck and others against the White House green job czar, Van Jones, who resigned, and the Acorn story, which the mainstream media was very slow to pick up on, those videotapes of the undercover couple posing as a prostitute and a pimp. In other words, a cable can get a story on the front page of the New York Times, can influence the debate among the political elite, so the sheer numbers are less important than it's a battlefield that journalists maybe pay too much attention to, but they do pay attention.
The more attention you draw to Fox, the more that debate goes into the mainstream. So I think we probably agree that they're making Fox more important.
Fox News loves this sort of thing. I knew as soon as I got off the set with Anita Dunn that this would be a prime topic of conversation the next day on Glenn Beck, on O'Reilly, that they would ride this. They love to be under attack. It enables the people at Fox News to position themselves as the only news outlet that is holding the Obama administration's feet to the fire. They revel in the attention. They have people come on to debate it. So I don't think that the White House wanted to help Fox News, but it certainly produced days of coverage of which Fox was at the center.
Nevertheless, the charge wasn't wrong.
Why do you say the charge wasn't wrong?
Because Fox News has reflexively reflected the views of the most far-right flank of the Republican Party, reliably.
I would say that Sean Hannity is out there almost as a spokesman for the Republican Party. I would say Bill O'Reilly can be unpredictable sometimes. For example, he said it was a good thing for America that President Obama had won the Nobel Peace Prize. That was not the majority view at Fox. And Glenn Beck claims not to like either party, but let's face it, he's out there bashing the president in a very high decibel way. But again, if you take the biggest personalities and you don't look at Shepard Smith, who anchors a pretty straight news hour on Fox, and you don't look at Major Garrett, who even Anita Dunn says is a pretty straight White House correspondent, Glenn Beck called President Obama racist. If White House wants to push back on that, be my guest. But the broad brush approach here, whether it's warranted or not, I would just say might be counterproductive.
Do you watch Fox News coverage?
I watch all the cable channels all the time. I'm part of my job.
I'm so sorry. And you don't notice a certain bias in the weight given particular stories as opposed to other stories?
There's no question in my mind that when Fox News as an entity wants to drive a particular story, it does have a way of being at the top of the regular newscast as well as the primetime opinion shows. And sometimes that completely, you know, exaggerates the impact of a Bill Ayers controversy, for example. On the other hand, the Acorn story, the rest of the mainstream media was slow on. It turned out to be a legitimate story. Congress voted to cut off funding.
They were late on the Acorn story, and we can always point to an example here or there. But the fact is, the mainstream media have been holding Obama's feet to the fire.
I think you've hit on the key point, because in that original Time magazine article where Anita Dunn took her first shot at Fox News, she also took shots at the New York Times and the Washington Post. They are frustrated, and frankly, I think it's because they are not used to what is the typical aggressive and sometimes almost confrontational coverage from the media. This is what we do. We're not supposed to get along with these people. They're not our friends. We're supposed to hold them accountable. So Fox stands in the White House pantheon as the most aggressive and unfair, they would say, news outlet, but they're not all that happy with the rest of us either.
Howie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Howard Kurtz is a columnist for The Washington Post and host of CNN's Reliable Sources. And here's Fox News Channel's Glenn Beck savoring the moment.
See that phone? That phone is directly to Anita. She is the only one that has the phone number. We have confirmation that she has the phone number. She is the one that the White House has put in charge to lead the campaign against Fox News and this program. Call me, Anita. Call me. I'm begging you. Call me. Correct me. Tell me. Tell me what I put up on the chalkboard yesterday.
Have you ever felt like the web you're watching is watching you back? You know, like when an ad pops up on your screen for a t-shirt of your favorite band, which you listed as your favorite on your Facebook page. That kind of marketing, called behavioral advertising, where marketers track where you go and what you do on the web in order to sell you things. It's pretty much the norm these days. And marketers have always said that people don't mind because the ads are for the stuff they might actually want. But a study that came out last month, done by the University of Pennsylvania and the University of California at Berkeley, found that nearly two-thirds of people are against tailored ads. Professor Joseph Turow, lead author of the study, says the implications strike at the heart of the digital privacy issue.
What the public is concerned about is that the pictures that advertisers draw about you are becoming more and more vivid. And whether or not they have pictures that you would agree with is a really big question. So I think the issue here is how much do people know about what's going on and do they have any control over it? So, for example, if you get an ad, say, from NewYorkTimes.com and it's tailored to you, it would be great if there were a way that you could know, A, that it's tailored for you, B, where did they get those data from, C, how does it fit into a larger picture of you that that advertiser or that periodical has, and can you do anything about it?
Now, you had warned that if nothing is done on this issue, that it could really spiral out of control. What's the nightmare scenario that you see, say, a decade from now?
Well, the scenario I see, whether we call it a nightmare or not, is the digitization of all media and their interconnection. The kinds of activities that are being tested in the internet are going to be applied quite directly to television, to stores, to other areas, and they're going to be interconnected. We're setting up a situation where people will feel that their reputations may affect even what 60 minutes they see. It's quite possible, for example, to imagine a 60 Minutes program that I get that's very different than the 60 Minutes program you get because of the sociodemographics and psychographics that they've decided about you versus me.
Some of that went on even in the analog world where there were zoned editions of newspapers based on your geographical interests. But the digital world enables you to slice and dice that a batrillion ways. Maybe now people are just beginning to realize it.
I think that's true. And I think that there are contradictions here and complexities. There's actually a lot more data that supermarkets have about you than most websites. People, studies have shown, including ours, are much more concerned about the online world than the offline world, when there's a lot more data flow about you going on in the offline world than in the online world.
Which you've absolutely surrendered, you know, in exchange for 9 cents off of a can of clam chowder. You're using your discount card, and they are tracking all of your Preparation H purchases and everything else.
And right now, most people don't see that because supermarkets haven't quite figured out what to do with all those data. But when they start doing that, and when the mobile phone gets connected to the supermarket activity, and when all of that gets connected to your online data, that's when that confluence of forces, that perfect storm, might erupt.
I want to ask you about privacy in general, because all of these issues seem to boil down to people's sense of the right of privacy being absolute. But increasingly in the 21st century, privacy is kind of a commodity, isn't it? That travelers exchange for security and then celebrities exchange for celebrity. Do you think that one of the outcomes of this 10 years from now is that people will be more likely to understand that their privacy is a commodity that they can trade for something of value?
I think some people understand that now, but it's really an ethical, societal question that we have to deal with. Basically, the question is your data, information about you, is it body or barter? Is it something that belongs to you, that you want to keep it and husband to yourself, or is it something you're willing to trade? And also, who owns that information? The point is, I'm not against behavioral targeting. I'm against behavioral targeting that takes place in a situation where people have no knowledge and no control.
Well, Joe, thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Professor Joseph Turow is the lead author of the study and professor of communication at the Annenberg School for Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. You probably don't know the name of the chairman of Intel Corporation or of IBM Corporation, but I'll bet you know the name of the chairman of News Corporation, because that chairman is Rupert Murdoch, a mogul, a celebrity basking in the reflected glamour of the real celebrities on his payroll. But how celebrated should Rupert Murdoch and his fellow moguls be? In a new book titled The Curse of the Media Mogul, authors Jonathan Nee, Bruce Greenwald, and Ava Sieve reveal that the moguls have no clothes, or at least profit margins, to speak of. Ava Sieve joins us now, and before she does, let me just say that I have known this woman since I was 5 years old. Hey, Ava, welcome to the show.
Hi, Bob.
In terms of profitability, Hollywood, good business or bad business?
Terrible business. It's always been a terrible business.
Video game publishing business, good business or bad business?
Well, it's good in some places and bad in some places. There are places to make money. However, the people who manufacture the boxes, they do not make any money on the boxes. Those are essentially loss leaders in order to do the publishing of the video games.
TV networks, good business, bad business?
It's been a really, really good business for a really long time. NBC notwithstanding, they cooperate legally. They don't poach on each other's stars, and they keep their costs relatively low.
We have this notion of Disney and Viacom and Time Warner and most especially News Corp, Rupert Murdoch's company, as being these Leviathan corporations that have their way with every business that they enter. Turns out that they barely outperform for their shareholders U.S. savings bonds in many cases. How could this be?
Well, I think a lot of the companies that you mentioned were started by entrepreneurs who actually were good at business and a particular kind of business, and they did make money in their histories. But what happened over the years is that these moguls did not get the memo that conglomerates don't really work. And because they are addicted to growth and they think that any kind of purchasing or growth is good, they proceeded to buy companies that sound like they possibly have something to do with the original company, but in fact, they have completely different cost structures, completely different management structures. And so the management is completely distracted, and in the end, they actually don't make any money in most of the businesses that they own.
Now, to read the book, you get inside not only the balance sheets, but the heads of people like Sumner Redstone and Rupert Murdoch. And I guess it's tempting to imagine them as just so vain and self-regarding that they care little about their shareholders and only about their own egos. But in fairness, Wall Street as an institution does love growth. And if you're not growing on the top line on revenues, Wall Street tends to devalue your stock. Isn't part of the fault the system itself?
Well, I mean, first of all, most of the guys you just named own all the voting rights on their shares. Even though they have a smaller economic interest in the firms, they actually control the firms in a lot of ways. Growth, it has to be profitable growth. Part of the problem is that a lot of people who cover the media are just in love with the glamour of it. And they follow these guys as if they are gods, what they eat for breakfast. I mean, we shouldn't care about where they get reservations. We shouldn't care about the stars they hang out with. And when stars and agents and people like that say how terrific the moguls are or the executives are, the public is looking at this glamour instead of looking at these businesses as real businesses. Media businesses are like everything else, and they should be treated as such.
You were talking about the image of these tycoons, the moguls, an image that is perpetuated in the very media that they own. Sumner Redstone and Rupert Murdoch are portrayed as, you know, kind of geniuses. even when their biggest deals turn out to be not so ingenious after all. Are we causing harm in portraying them as these great omniscient visionaries?
I think that the people who write about these media moguls are doing a disservice. The return on investment doesn't get judged, but just how they appear in the media and talk about their businesses rather than making money for the shareholders.
You and your co-authors repeatedly point out in The Curse of the Mogul, you have to maintain and actually reinforce barriers of entry that make it harder and harder for little guys to come in and poach on your market share. But in a digital world, the barriers of entry in many of these businesses have been reduced to near zero. Do the moguls have any future whatsoever?
In media industries which are being affected by the digital revolution, like music, it's going to be really hard for what were called the majors to continue to make money because there's so many people who can actually create music and distribute music and really don't need the big companies. So yes, you're right. The moguls are in trouble. However, there are ways that you can run businesses efficiently, and maybe you don't have a competitive advantage, which is what we talk about, but that you can actually still give an okay return to your shareholders. It's just not going to be as pretty as it was in the past. There are going to be many fewer people who make a really good living, and there's going to be a lot of people who are in it because they like the idea of creating music or making movies or that kind of thing.
All right, Ava. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ava Sieve is co-author, along with Jonathan Nee and Bruce Greenwald, of The Curse of the Mogul, What's Wrong with the World's Leading Media Companies.
Coming up, how in the Depression, the only way forward was to face the music and dance.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
From all corners of the world, heroes are being called to join a quest that will decide the fate of Nu'rath.
EverQuest 2 is a massively multiplayer online role-playing game. It is not the Gallup poll. But some social scientists think it actually may offer a clearer picture of human behavior than standard surveys, which generally rely on respondents answering randomly selected phones. Dimitri Williams, assistant professor at the Annenberg School for Communication, is part of a group of researchers who believe that they can get better information about our public predilections than polls can provide through these massively multiplayer online games, even in a realm of elves, dwarves, ogres, and trolls. He argues that recording every single action by the human-controlled characters in EverQuest 2 is better than any study conducted offline.
There's a big difference between knowing what somebody did and asking them what they did. When we do standard survey research, we always have to worry about whether or not the people are giving us accurate answers. They might give us inaccurate answers based on what they want us to hear or what they want to think about themselves, or they might simply get the information wrong.
So why EverQuest 2?
Well, the main reason that we used EverQuest 2 is because the game makers, Sony Online Entertainment, were nice enough to work with us. So why we picked that particular game wasn't because we really liked gnomes or dragons. We simply got the data we could get. These online worlds record just about everything that anybody does. So you can imagine if your life was recorded second by second. Everything that you did, every action, every interaction, every transaction. You got in your car, you drove to work, you did this, you did that. In a virtual space, if you acquire some gold coins or, you know, slay a big spider or something, it wants to know that and it keeps a record of it. So it's just like a very, very good journal keeping of behaviors and actions.
What is it you're tracking?
It's hard to get your head around, you know, who's slaying a dragon. But everybody understands buying and selling goods, and a big part of the action and the play of these games is people buying and selling items, making items, repairing items. That lets us track an entire economy and measure supply and demand. And we can do it with such a level of detail that it's better than anything you could get offline. For example, when the United States wants to make an estimate about what's going on with GDP, it is just that. It's an estimate. What we have is every single transaction that ever happened, period.
Not only are you dealing with a world that bears very little resemblance to the real world, you're also dealing with demographics that are very different from the real world. These players are younger, they're wealthier, they're whiter, they're more male. I don't see how you can extract useful information.
The phenomenon you're talking about is something I call mapping. And that's the sense that, is the behavior in the virtual world valid outside? In other words, can we say that the things that happen inside do in fact happen outside? And the honest answer is, in some cases it is, definitely. In some cases, it definitely is not. A couple years ago, in the very popular online world, World of Warcraft, there was an incident called the Ironforge Plague. And so what happened was you had an epidemiological event going on where people were infecting each other from person to person around the city. And epidemiologists thought, wow, what a great way to study disease vectors. It would be, except that the behaviors in a virtual world are very different than the offline world in this respect. The risks of death and the feeling of pain don't map from A to B. So you wouldn't want to look at people's virtual behavior in that sense and say, oh, that tells us how people are going to behave in a disease outbreak. It wouldn't, because in a disease outbreak, you don't run around cackling with glee and trying to kill your friends. But in the virtual world, you would.
If there are no consequences, maybe you'd be much more willing to go broke in a virtual world than you would in the real one.
You could imagine that, you know, maybe the players wouldn't take it seriously and they would fritter away their money or they wouldn't make rational purchasing decisions. But it turns out they behave exactly like a real-world offline market. And so it's that kind of confirmation that was a nice first step.
You could confirm that you could apply this method to track behavior in the market realm.
You know, eventually what we'd like to do is be able to also then alter the world or do experiments, because we're not the game developers. We can't, you know, change the price of something and then see what happens or change the structure. But you could see how powerful that method could be if you could basically do a live experiment with control and treatment groups and hundreds of thousands of people. That's something that no scientist has been able to do before.
So how could studying EverQuest 2 have led you to possibly predict what happened in the real world with regard to the recent economic collapse?
Now, flashback 5-6 months ago when everybody's arguing about what should we do to fix the economy? Do we bail out banks? Do we subsidize certain industries? Well, we essentially did a large-scale trillion-dollar experiment with live people. And the idea that you could do this in a virtual world, in a sense, a simulation, but with real people for substantially lower costs, for maybe, you know, $100,000, you could find out what would happen in an economy given certain policy choices. It's the power of that idea that makes this potential so strong.
Dr. Williams, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dimitri Williams is an assistant professor in the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California. In Woody Allen's film The Purple Rose of Cairo, a young woman in Depression-era New York City escapes from her dreary life into a world of glamour and romance and money on the movie screen. That is, until the movie's male hero walks off the big screen and into her little life.
I'm confused. I'm married. I just met a wonderful new man. He's fictional, but you can't have everything.
In his new cultural history of the Great Depression, Dancing in the Dark, Morris Dickstein examines artifacts of the era, ranging from the social realist novels to the Busby Berkeley musicals. I wondered what he thought of Purple Rose of Cairo.
I love the movie, but it's really based on the cliche that people went to the movies simply to escape their problems. And if you look at the movies themselves, and they went to very silly movies, but if you look at the movies that we still look at, they're anything but silly. They're very marked by people's problems and concerns. And so, you know, I take that at really as the stereotype of depression culture, pretty much against which I've written this book.
In other words, he says, when we peer back through time, what looks like escape really is exploration.
What people call the escapist stories, such as Busby Berkeley, I find full of references to the Depression. I like to say that the only difference is that some of the references to the Depression are simply more oblique than others. They're very direct in Busby Berkeley. Much more oblique, for example, in the Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers movies or in the screwball comedies. But I don't think they can be understood except as artifacts of the Depression.
And when you say direct, you mean that the Busby Berkeley musicals depicted struggling showgirls?
Well, yeah, the showgirl was one of the main figures of Depression in the sense of that she was often out of work or subject to the vagaries of the market. One of the best of these stories, The Gold Diggers of 1933, starts with rehearsing a show that's called We're in the Money.
We're in the money, we're in the money. We've got a lot of what it takes to get along.
You see these surreal showgirls wearing large coins that barely cover their bodies, and in comes the sheriff to interrupt the number and close the show. So it couldn't be more explicit than that, except, of course, later on it is more explicit than that. Then you have the concluding number called Remember My Forgotten Man, and that's the figure that Roosevelt had first mentioned in a 1932 campaign speech and got associated with the veterans of World War I who are now being neglected and who just earlier had been camped out in Washington trying to get early payment of their bonuses. So this is a very direct contemporary reference.
There's another one in the fabulous screwball comedy, My Man Godfrey. The idle rich go out in search of a bunch of items, one of which is supposed to be a forgotten man. And the wealthy but adorable Carol Lombard finds William Powell.
Do you mind telling me just what a scavenger hunt is?
Well, a scavenger hunt is exactly like a treasure hunt. Except in a treasure hunt, you try to find something you want. And in a scavenger hunt, you try to find something that nobody wants.
Like a forgotten man.
That's right, and the one that wins gets a prize. Only there really isn't a prize. It's just the honor of winning, because all the money goes to charity. That is, if there's any money left over, but then there never is.
And William Powell, of course, turns out to be a hobo living in a Hooverville encampment on the shores of the East River, which was pretty much a slum at the time. But, of course, he turns out to be originally a Boston Brahmin who nearly committed suicide but stopped just short of the river and ended up being a forgotten man. He, in a sense, rescues this daffy rich family from its own waywardness, even rescues their financial investments. And
transforms the Hooverville as well.
Right, and transforms it into a nightclub called The Dump. Very enterprising, and you might say there's a real belief in free enterprise there rather than government programs.
Let's talk about the most iconic duo of the period I mentioned in the intro, Astaire and Rogers. This is always regarded as the quintessence of escapist fare, but you suggest that it really wasn't that at all.
Well, here you have two people. They don't know what everyone else knows, that they're made for each other, and they're so perfect, and yet, of course, they can't agree on a single thing. They misunderstand everything the other one does. And then at certain moments, suddenly they're in tune with each other, and it's not when they're speaking, but it's only when they're dancing. And when they're dancing, they're suddenly sublimely together. And this turns out to be an emblem of Depression culture as a whole. It's all about separately we fail, but together we may actually be able to face the music.
There may be trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face.
So I find a lot of the culture to be very parallel to the New Deal, because the New Deal was giving exactly the same message. No one had ever believed that federal government was really that responsible for the American people's welfare, and suddenly Roosevelt convinced them that we had to all pull together. And so I like to say that besides the New Deal, the arts were the other big stimulus package of the Great Depression.
Let's drill into the dance a little bit more. You have the dance of the showgirls in the Busby Berkeley musicals, and then you have this dance of Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, which, though very carefully choreographed, has a certain almost improvisational quality in the way that it's performed. Was there something about the way that Astaire and Rogers danced that made it different from other dance?
Well, one thing is, of course, that in many European countries, the Depression took the form of social unrest and seeking extreme solutions, fascism, communism, and so on. In America, it took this form of stagnation and also of self-blame and stasis. Even people who were moving around, people taking to the road, were lamely moving from place to place with really no hope of finding anything better at the other end. One beautiful emblem of that is the vogue of marathon dancing, where people round, going round and round and round, going absolutely nowhere. And this is why I think energy and movement became one of the main themes of Depression culture. there was a tremendous push to get the country moving again, and FDR and Warner Brothers were really on the same page. Now, in Astaire, you have something in addition to that that's very, very special and very important to Depression culture, and that is this extraordinary elegance, this extraordinary grace of movement that had to be supplying something that was a psychological boost, a boost of morale, that I think gradually turned the Depression from really despair to hopefulness in a way that becomes very marked later in the decade.
So we've talked about how the films that we might dismiss as purely escapist artifacts were much, much more. You make the same argument about the gangster film.
Well, in the first part of my book, I deal with people who are really down and out. I mean, really tremendous poverty and deprivation, despair. In the second part of the book, I deal more with middle-class problems, which largely were a concern with failure, a fear of falling. You know, as FDR said, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. And that concern got translated into fascination with parables of success and failure, of sudden changes in fate and fortune. And there you have the showgirl story of the girl stepping out of the chorus and suddenly becoming a star. But you also have the gangster ruthlessly working his way up from the gutter and ending up in the end in the gutter again, but in a way that represented a very complex form of identification on the part of the audience.
I wonder what to do with so much dough.
Ah, yeah, it started. I'll make big shots out of you yet.
Anything you say goes to me, Patty.
Me too. And here's to us.
On the one hand, it's charged with energy. The way Edward G. Robinson or Jimmy Cagney in The Public Enemy played it is just crackling with energy. But it's also, it's in a way a remnant, a reference to the old self-help mentality. This is the way we can still do it in a world in which business is not really functioning. We do it as gangsters. We do it in the old 1920s Al Capone mode.
When Dutch comes around, he's going to leave you some beer, and you're going to take it, and you're going to kick him with the dough. If you don't, somebody's going to drop by here and kick your teeth out one at a time. Get me?
Yeah, and you'll be needing some right away. How many shall we leave?
Oh, two kegs.
You hear that, Dutch? Bring in five kegs.
Beginning very early in the 30s, studios like Warner Brothers had to put disclaimers at the beginnings of movies like The Public Enemy saying this is only a documentary about a problem of our society. This is not something that anyone would want to identify with. But of course, those disclaimers are meaningless because it's the energy of the performance that really carries you.
So the New York Times a few weeks ago had a piece about how the recession was creeping into the fall crop of TV shows, not necessarily in a literal way. You'd have somebody suffering the economic downturn of the 80s or have somebody who lost a job for reasons other than the current recession. Was this technique of swapping out the present for an analogous era also deployed in the 30s?
Yes, very often these things were done in historical novels. I mean, Gone with the Wind is certainly a Depression movie. It's about living through the after effects of catastrophe, about a strong woman trying to hold things together. In that respect, it's even like Grapes of Wrath. I interpret even The Wizard of Oz as a kind of road story in which you have a catastrophic situation. The beginning and the end of the movie are in black and white, and you see a very much a Depression-era Kansas. Then you take to the road. Judy Garland rescues first the proletariat of Oz, the Munchkins, and then she joins up with other characters in that kind of solidarity. They're looking for just those qualities that were needed during the Depression. They're looking for heart, for mind, for courage, and they take the yellow brick road.
Then she goes to Oz and meets up with this big fraud who's the wizard. Am I seeing some sort of political dialectic here that I oughtn't?
Well, you're seeing something that's certainly politically ambiguous because I'm not the first one to compare The Wizard of Oz to FDR. And there were a lot of figures in 30s movies that looked a little like FDR. On the other hand, the message could even be seen as a Republican message. It's not government help. It's not the wizard's help that you need. It's self-help. And so there's a wonderful political ambiguity there.
Self-help and ruby slippers.
Right.
So as you stare down this telescope into an era so many decades ago, where do you see the greatest contrast?
Well, the fact that people were doing things to a remarkable extent together. In other words, they went to the movies together. They went to movies as a habit. They all saw the same movies each week. When FDR went on for one of his fireside chats, everyone listened to it. It was the one thing that was available. There was nothing competing with it. That may be somewhat true today when Obama gives an address to a joint session of Congress, but I think largely now we have hundreds of cultural choices today.
So we won't have the pop culture to pull us all together.
There'll always be crazes. There'll be a Dan Brown craze. There'll be a craze for an American Idol and so on. People, in many ways, like to do things that other people are doing, and they like to talk about it with them. This is why one of the reasons that sports is the lingua franca of conversation in many parts of the country.
But we won't be able to rely on the pop culture to unify us during this time, to make us feel less afraid and less alone.
I don't think so. The culture, I think, is fragmenting in too many different directions.
Morris Dickstein is a professor of English and theater at the City University of New York and author of Dancing in the Dark, A Cultural History of the Great Depression. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with more help from James Harver and Dan Mazzi, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there or email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.